is 25 Years of Vampire the Masquerade, a retrospective podcast brought to you by UtilityMuffinLabs.com. Welcome to the Dark Ages.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of 25 Years of Vampire the Masquerade. My name is Nathan. In this episode, we are going to be doing the first part of our Dark Ages Vampire core book review. Unfortunately, due to some unforeseen circumstances, the audio quality on Bob's end is a little lacking. What happened was, apparently, his apartment complex decided it was time to rebuild the building while we were doing the podcast. So it got to the point where it was bad enough that we had to stop the recording. However, we will be back next week with our second part of this review. If you hear some knocking and some pounding, it was something that couldn't be avoided, but we wanted to preserve the quality of the podcast overall, stop it after an hour of recording, and we'll pick it back up with our next episode next week. Thank you for your patience and thank you for your understanding, and let's just get right into it. Welcome to another episode of 25 Years of Vampire the Masquerade. My name is Nathan.
And I am Bob.
And today we are returning with a book review, a main core book, Dark Ages Vampire. So before we get started, how's it going, Bob?
It's going pretty good. A little loud. So if you hear some knocking, that's them finding a leak in my roof and finally fixing it. So that's good. Well, it's not good for us recording, but it's good it's getting done.
Good you're not leaking. The only thing we really have today before we get into this review of this core book is just a couple of shout outs from some of our new Patreon backers. And we want to say thank you to Sir Merrick, to Jordan, and to Coriton Strait. I don't know if I pronounced that right, but it looks correct. So let us know if we pronounce it incorrectly. That's it. That's all we got. We don't got no questions, no comments. And the reason why we don't have any of that stuff is because this is a big book, right?
It is a big book.
Yeah, it's rare that we're going to go through a book like this and it's going to be a short podcast. We'll do our best to keep it concise and keep it on track. So, all right. What you think, Bob? Where should we start here?
Well, I think always you start at the beginning. It's a good part. And I'm gonna skip the intro. I know it's good. It was a decent read, but at the same time, there is a lot to go over. So
yeah,
I would rather just kind of start noticing the differences in the book from previous to now. And actually overall, and just a quick head nod, I had taken the idea of, just all the books that we're going through, you can see where they started with the origins, seeding all these stories.
Yeah.
And some of them are left out in left field, and we riffed a bit about that. That just seems like it was chaotic. This book is quintessentially the best put book together so far that we've reviewed.
Yeah, I would agree with you. Right? I think that this one is put together very precisely, and based on all of the previous information, I think it does a great job of quickly summarizing and bringing us right into the meat and potatoes of this game.
Much like this podcast, no nonsense. Here it is. You enjoy.
Well, sometimes we have nonsense. Sometimes.
I'm referring today.
Yeah, right.
Today is special. Right. So, the number one difference here, let's talk about the vampire itself, right? First off, I want to give a quick head nod to Anne Rice, who heavily influenced, no doubt, the idea of what we consider the vampire and a vampire genre. Mm-hmm. And this is where I feel it completely altered their typical view of the game. I took the liberty of going back and looking at the kind of attempts mm-hmm. to explain vampire physiology and whatnot. And then when I read this, I was like, am I reading Interview with the Vampire?
Yeah.
Right? And I don't mean that in any insult. Right. It's like, to me, when I think of the quintessential vampire, there's two versions, right? And ironically, they coincide with the high clans versus low clans. You know, when you think of the ones that are emboldened in society and all the high lofty romanticism, hierarchy, high clan age that we'll get mm-hmm. into, I think of the Man Rice vampires, you know?
Right.
We're talking, they describe the marble-like flesh. They talk about having all blemishes removed upon being embraced.
Right.
The gum line receding so the fang can be enough to be pronounced so they can feed. Hair like gossamer, like a beautiful doll. And I sat there and I went, I couldn't stop doing it. I was like, okay, this is great. Let me go look at one of the novels off the shelf and how she describes, oh yeah, right here, every vampire she's described, there's bits of it, right?
Right.
I don't mind that cosign. I think it's an awesome head nod. And here's why, folks. If you're wondering, Bob's just being blah, blah. No, I'm not. The fact of the matter is that in 2002, February, they released Queen of the Damned, right? It was a hotly anticipated sequel to what Anne Rice came out with in 94, which is Interview with the Vampire. And Interview with the Vampire was beloved by the vampire community. It was absolutely adored. Got everybody reading the novels. You couldn't go anywhere without talking about it for a time. And then when Queen of the Damned hit, they were like, meh.
Yeah, yeah.
we've done this enough.
Well, and I think that to your point, that Interview with a Vampire, for me in like my youth, my formative years, it definitely presented a new perspective in pop culture of the vampire. I feel that in years past, vampires were typically either presented as just like sort of mindless monstrosities, or like, you know, nothing against like the Lost Boys or anything, but kind of like the one-dimensional villain.
Right.
And
right.
And with that movie, and obviously that's not the first time in fiction, but with that movie, a young person like me kind of saw it in a different way, that these were nuanced characters that were sort of living through the ages and not just like savage monstrosities chewing up people.
And that's the beauty of it. It's when you have both, though, you kind of have the vampire myth in total, right? Because vampires were just brutal things that you could just smoke, right? Just what I mean by that, burn in the sunlight.
Right.
You get together with hunters and you kill them and they're virtually mindless.
Right.
And then you have these high-end profiled, well, in-depth and content-rich, romantic, tragic, all that that is. It's like, well, where's the line? Well, interesting enough, they do blend it here.
Yep.
I think they capture it here in this book, and they talk about one of the distinctions here. It says that the blood in and of itself is a curse. It's an absolute curse. It's one that does many things. First and foremost, in print, we have right here, where I got it from, and I couldn't relate a long time ago. One time you said Vitej is blood, and it's absolutely not.
Right.
It's not just blood.
No,
it is the curse. It is vampiric blood.
Right.
And that's not you as a misnomer. This book wasn't read by you yet.
Right.
Right? And I couldn't recall where I got it from. I was like, okay, we'll just stick with that till I could read it. Boom, here it is. And it's Primacy of Blood Defined.
Mm-hmm.
And they do that on purpose. Because a vampire, if you're carrying the curse of God or whatever in your blood, there should be a difference between your blood and Joe Average typo.
Yeah.
Right? And that's what they get to. So other than that, we also get into the attempt to, they basically rally Cain into embracing only three children that they mention here. That's another difference.
Mm-hmm.
What I mean by rally, they don't mince words. They're not sitting in here and telling you that, well, Cain made many and they killed each other off in another city. No. It says Cain had three, right? Those three had 13. That's it.
Well, so an interesting thing for me, you know, I read that and I read all of that matter-of-fact information too. And how I interpreted this and how I interpreted most of the stuff in the beginning of this book was, this is written from the perspective, again, this is just my, you know, how I perceived it, but this is written from the perspective of the time, right? Like this is how they believe.
Yeah, but we're going in order.
Right. Of course.
Right. So yeah. we gotta paint this orange here.
Right.
And when you allude to the antediluvians, you know, being spoken of and the fact that they talk about, you know, the generation gaps or whatever, they're establishing a term later on we'll get back to called the Covenant of Cain.
Yep.
And what it is the Book of Nod becomes everything to vampires. They're basically mimicking mortals to this point, but I don't want to lose you, the listener, by separating here. Because I kind of had a methodology, and I know Nate's going to be awesome in expanding on these ideas too. So when you think of Book of Nod, I want you to think that they made a book called the Book of Nod, and this is in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, hey, here's a prop. It's been out. Maybe you get it.
Right.
You know, maybe you don't.
Right.
Right. But it's around. And you reach these fragments around, maybe you get it, maybe you don't. And there's a Book of Lilith around, again, get it or don't. But this book says flat out, yeah, we use them all and they're all in character. They're all usable for that very reason, because there's many copies, all people, all sorts have it.
Right.
And you should be aware of it, right? Why it's beautiful is that, one, it gets you to use more to your product, right? It doesn't just sit on the shelf collecting dust, I thought. The other thing is that it tells you the fact that you're supposed to be pulling legend and lore from that to help you get those complex thoughts. Because how many times have you had a player go, man, I want to know about the history and the origins.
Right.
It's like, what is the history and origins beyond the clan books? So, yeah, there's these books they made.
Yeah. right. Well, and then, in certain circumstances, you hand the player that book, and then they're like, oh, wait, I got to read all this?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Unfortunately, you know.
or don't, right. but it's there for that. Other like a brain explosion. We get to the whole idea of Lilith, right? Codified, they say Lilith is a source of Cain's vampiric disciplines and blood magic, according to the Book of Nod.
Mm-hmm.
It's also cited as the reason gender equality amongst vampires exists is because she's in there.
Right.
Right? That they don't see gender when it's a vampire. However, they're quick to point out, vampires are ever part of the era. They're part of the time that they are frozen in, right? And so because of that, there are certain sometimes Christian vampires who are moral, or any type, but they cite Christian. Mm-hmm. To me, it was anyone. Who has women as a second-class citizen, guess what? It's going to be a hard habit to break.
Right. Well,
and it points that
out. You know, even if that's the case in scenarios where, you know, you are interacting with the mortals are going to impose restrictions. And in many cases, those Cainites are going to adapt them because they don't have a choice.
Right. And before you think that's, oh, great, so now women suck again. No, not at all. In fact, woe be that guy who decides to tell you, I want you to think about this for a minute, ladies. It's been told to you in this new group that we're all equal because the God Paragon, Cain himself, has stated you are all my children, and thus the only one above you is me. Right? And then he says right. The eldest and all that other jazz, and we'll get to that later. But nowhere does he say women suck. In fact, he owes his power to what Lilith taught him. And right. So, if you're part of that group and someone walks up and goes, women are garbage, you vampire women better get back to cleaning the house and catching my herd. It's like, oh, that's true? Yeah, stake him and leave him out in the sun. Let him see what God thinks about that.
Right. Right. At the beginning here, too, I love how they kind of formulate what vampires are. And I think that in a lot of ways, people forget about things like this. I just have one little line that I highlighted that I thought really... encapsulated why humans and vampires are different. And it says here, the joys and sorrows of life are missing from undeath, and vampires replace them with obsession, lust, hatred, and envy. And this is something that we have focused on in a lot of our games, that we as people and players, we feel love and we feel genuine concern. But when you become a vampire, when you're embraced, all you do is you remember the hollow echoes of what those feelings were like. And I love that they overtly state that in here. Like you remember what it's like to be human, but you're not. Those feelings are always false.
As they say later on, it's that they're stunted. Mm-hmm. You know, you're frozen in time. The state of which you embrace is what you will be for all time, but immediately those emotions are divorced of you.
Right.
Or stunted, as I said, meaning in layman's terms, basically you can't relate. You know, not well anyway, and even if you do, it's like a hollow memory, like you said, and the beast is still there going, this is real emotion.
Right.
This is what you should care about.
Right.
Which makes you a wholly instinctual and selfish predator. But it's battling with the memory, or humanity currently,
mm-hmm.
That you once remembered, right? And so, with this, they roll into, oh, here's something I forgot. I like it. I wanted to tell you this directly. On here, I love this, that through the use of disciplines, Cainites indulge the beast. It's something we've screamed about.
Yeah.
Right? For a player shooting through the roof, taking every XP to dump as soon as they can into all their disciplines, you're basically saying goodbye to your humanity.
Yeah.
That's what you're saying. You're telling the beast you're in charge. This is your ship. Do what you do. When everything is a nail and you're the hammer, there's only, you know, the beast you are, the beast you become. And that is definitely highlighted here as they warn it, right?
Right.
I enjoy that very much. The point overall here is that what we're talking about is to bring us back. Like you take back a step, because I think in the Dark Ages before, at least I felt, it was the Wild Bunch.
Yeah.
Make your gang girl, you're a knight, doesn't matter, you're running about, whatever, the Crusades are going on, let's live it up. Like, whatever you're doing, have fun. Yeah. You know? And this is like, well, let's look at what you are.
Yeah. I think that what this does is it does a very great job. And it's not to say that the previous Dark Ages book didn't do this, but I feel like it does a very good job up front of explaining to you intimately, again, that you are a vampire. You're not just, you know, a knight who happens to only be able to go out during the night. Like, you are a vampire, and you're because this benefits from the great work that they did in the revised edition of Vampire the Masquerade. And I felt, and I've had this debate with people plenty of times, but I felt that the revised edition did a really good job of explaining to you that you are once again Kainite or kindred vampire. And there is that struggle. And this, there's very few Kainites who are adherents to that path of humanity. Most of them are on other roads, on other paths, and they are using human beings as playthings to be mangled and tortured like flies in the hands of demented children, because that shit's written right there. So,
well, and there's little you could do about it other than to think that is Zara what you want it to be. I mean, at this point, well, let's just look at it before. Before, there was no rule, no one to tell you the eldest is the one who was in charge. That was it. Right, there wasn't really any extension from it other than if you did something wrong, they'd come for you. Right, that's what we knew.
Right,
and here they start broadening into a whole entire society, which again, jumping a little ahead.
Mm-hmm.
But fun fact, people are going to want to know this. If that changed about the physiology and getting more defined to help you understand what you are, did they change the embrace, like the relationship between sire and child? Never before have you read so easily, and I would argue have read, how a sire should raise their child and have accounting.
Right.
And it walks you through it.
Right.
Right? It tells you about it. It doesn't clearly state, like, your sire should do X, Y, and Z. What it says is that when you're embraced and you get the blood, you can expect the following. Right?
Right.
It gives beautiful artwork of a woman who recently embraced another, a daughter of the night, if you will. And it shows her kind of, looks like she's vomiting.
Yeah.
Right? Something as well. And trying to teach her something. And that's what I got from it. Like, maybe she fed on the wrong stuff or thought she could still drink wine, and it went bad, right? And they're hashing it out. I thought that was very cool.
Yeah.
But never before, though, have I saw Domain talked about where, yeah, the first few years or maybe even decades, sometimes centuries, depending on the sire, you live on the domain of your sire.
Right.
That's where you are. You will learn from them, you will be as them, and you will hear what it is to be what it is you are now. And what's unique about this, in this game, they tell you flat out, which was the gap that you and I know riffed on, about how automatically you're embraced and suddenly you decide you're on a path.
Right.
It doesn't make any sense. There's nothing
nothing
that bridges that gap. Well, what backs that up is that here it's talking about how you're not just on a road.
Right.
Right? And folks, if you're in roads for the first time, just to review, because I know we've mentioned them before, definitely, a road is a vampire's philosophy of how to handle what they now are, right? Call it a rock in a storm versus just becoming the beast. It's something that helped them go, okay, I'm a predator now. These are my new ideals. Yep. This is my new ethos. This is what goes on. Well, here it talks about how Sire, once they embrace him, immediately starts teaching them about a road.
Right.
And does it have to be that road? Again, something we get into later. It gets very political savvy here. But initially, let's just assume yes, as the book outlines it. And they teach you how to feed. Teach you how to hunt.
Right.
Teach you where to stay, where to go, how to be. And why? Accounting.
Yeah, absolutely. Because the traditions of Cain, they're foundational. And here, when I'm reading through this stuff, Bob, like, it's very easy for me to see how the things that are foundational in the Dark Ages or in 1230 AD become the foundation for the Camarilla. How that evolves into, what we know today in the modern context. But one of the things about the roads that I found very interesting that maybe just hadn't been expressed or it hadn't clicked in my head was this sort of moment of inspiration, a moment of clarity where you gain an understanding and awareness on that path. That was something I thought was really, really awesome, where you may be an adherent to the road, right? And you may have, in game terms, one or two points in that road. And you're just sort of, you don't really understand. You kind of have a basic concept, but then there's a flash where now you have this understanding. I really appreciate
about
that.
Right. That's initiate to adherent to paragon. And it's just varying levels, folks. Yeah. Initiate's entry level, then it's adherent and all that jazz. What I enjoy about this, too, is that the mechanic of being on a road, you start on one. There's no talk about you having to hit a suspire and switch from one ethos to another. It literally says, just being embraced, being killed, and brought back, your sire needs to pour something to replace what you had.
Mm-hmm.
Or madness is what you inherit. The beast will win. And they believe that.
Right.
I love that that's here, right? But then they go, okay, great. You're going to be new on your own. You're off. You got a road. Go walk it. and, you know, Godspeed. Okay, great. But what they don't prepare you for, or what I like to call where immortality sucks, right? Right. They talk about flat out that your body, it's great that you are what you are, but welcome to no physical attraction whatsoever.
Right.
You don't have that. You hunger. And you do believe in, like, conquest predatory games of predator and prey, or beating another rival. And that's fine. Extreme pain can be there, and that's because it's a warning from the beast. However, you're aware, but not capable of enlightenment.
Right.
They make that distinction. I made sure to get that writing right. And basically, it says that you're static and therefore frozen in your era. Which means, you might go to the modern. But don't expect to pick up a Nintendo Game Boy and be like, oh, this is awesome, and start playing it for hours.
Right.
That's wizardry. That's still going to blow you away. And it mentions here that no matter what, you're from that era still. And because of that, all these innovations, you can learn the skills, but they never quite become part of you. Anachronism is part of immortality.
Yeah, it's the section on page 31. It's called The Curse of the Dead Heart, where I was like, yes, this here. And I had never read this book before. So, you know, for me, it was like, this is exactly the kind of things I've been talking about, you know, for years with people where I was like, you know, you're not just you now as a vampire, right? This curse really alters you. And again, it's probably just confirmation bias because I've read, you know, all the revised stuff. I've read all the V20 stuff. But like this one where, you know, it says, that vampires wear the masks of newly found customs, that they're not actually feeling them. They're not actually, you know, when that 20th century Ventru, who was actually born in the 10th century, wears that three-piece suit with the tie, he doesn't feel that. That's not him, right? When he's at home, he probably wants to put on the robes and the crown. That's just not what's available now, but he has to wear that mask.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I felt the same way. But this book is where I started going, you know what? This is where Bob projects all his viewpoints from this book. Right. I got where a lot of my perceptions came from. This is the philosopher's stone for me to everything else. And I judge it all through this because the V20 update, it was missing a lot when it comes to this. I felt great in the rules. Good job. You listen to fans, whatever. But it didn't feel mine.
Right.
Right. This is mine.
Yeah.
Right here.
Yeah.
This is the mentality. This is everything. It's the soul of what it is to be a vampire when you play it. And the most important part out of here is I actually made sure to get this part, same section, where it says the beast is the soul.
Right.
That is what your soul is. It's trapped within that middle ground where it should have died and separated but couldn't move on. And because it can't, that curse made it something else, something maddened, something that only relies on the basis of instincts. And because of that, it is a screaming thing looking to extend out, be dominant, and to kill, you know, to enjoy those moments. And we talked about a lot of it with the body and whatnot because it just was relevant when you jumped ahead. But talks about being dead in body and mind, and that's frightening. That's something I don't think a lot of people get.
Yeah.
So this here is when a storyteller tells you, okay, listen, the reason why you can't just start pouring points all over into all this stuff that you want to do after, like, if you're playing week to week, it's interesting how when you collect XP, people hang on to it and then one day spend 30 XP and justify getting college degrees and, you know, just expertise and all sorts of stuff when they didn't have anything there before. And it's just points spent. They call them just dots.
Right.
And I'm like, but are you thinking about how difficult that would be for you to accomplish into concept? And you might be thinking, man, you guys play a way more serious game than I do. Like, we don't worry about that with points. And then I challenged it. I said, that may be true. But why bother with immortality at all?
Right.
If you're just going to throw that to the side, and that's me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the argument can be made that, we're just looking to have a good old fashioned dice rolling good time. And my argument to that has always been there's probably better systems for that. But, you know, whatever. I'm not going to tell anybody they're wrong for how they're playing. I'm just saying as it's presented here, that's different than what's presented. Can we talk about, I don't know if you had other things you wanted to add, but one of the most important things here, I think, is the acknowledgement and the statement of high clan versus low clan.
That's further down the list, but
I'm cool with following your lead here. I make no lists.
Okay, so we went over a lot of this, but we went over the physical pleasure is not felt. Like we talked about that, so The concept of being forsaken in this era, this is another point. This is a LARP point of contention, why I wrote it down at all. You and me encounter this a lot.
Yeah.
Where people, I think when people make a vampire, they automatically try to say, screw you, I'm not part of your society, because guess what? I'm not going to be able to be in your hierarchy. I don't start in your plot. I'm just coming here, so you know what? I don't have to worry about it. It's not my thing. And the reality is, it's just not correct. Right? When you think about this, it's like, okay, cool, I get what you're saying, but you have to look at the fact that if you're going to play something that's automatically against what's already here, what are you really saying? You're saying I don't want to belong, but where's the danger? This is a group of predators that get together to take over a swath of territory that you're coming to and saying, yeah, I'm part of this domain.
Right.
I want to work here, right? And then what occurs is, while you're there, these people are going to hunt you. Right, because you're not a part of where they're at.
Right.
Maybe not immediately, but eventually they're going to go, well, if you're just here sucking up our resources, then we'll just get rid of you.
Yeah.
And that's that. Yeah.
No, I was just going to say, it really is. It comes down in a lot of ways to that resource hunt. To, you know, especially in the Dark Ages, territories are small. And it's a lot easier for a vampire, an elder vampire, to know exactly what's happening in their domain and know exactly who has access to it. But even more so, this is kind of codified in that whole War of Princes concept that emerges here.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And the main point is the spirituality piece, too, that we will get in. Obviously, we'll get into. But I want everybody to remember, in this era, vampires believe they are spiritually and physically plunged into damnation. Utter darkness.
Right.
This is why roads exist and are so easily acceptable. They feel they have to, because if you're in that era and you believe that because you're embraced, whether peasant or king, you're now this damned thing. No one cares. You have died. You are where you're at.
Right.
And so you only have these emotions to fuel you, and you don't have the emotions of yours we've already talked about. So if I only know lust and greed and jealousy, you will have to come with pitchfork and flame to deal with me relatively soon, right? And that is the nightmare about that. And so these roads are to help that. You know, they show that salvation could be there. Follow this road, get far enough, or just get on the road and learn to deal with who you and what you are.
Yeah.
And that's an important piece in it.
And also, we're going to, at some point in the near future, we're going to go into these roads in great detail, because those are actually, all the five major roads all have books. So, you know, we're going to exhaust those resources as well.
Exhaust them. So I chuckled here. I don't know if you caught that. Have you ever heard the term Knight Society when people talk about Requiem?
Yeah. I mean, I've heard the term. Yeah, of course.
I started cracking up when I read this section, because I was I recently played in a Requiem game, and it was always thrown at me like, you know, you learned more of Knight Society, and I was thinking of Clive Barker's Nightbreed. Whenever it said, like, I belong to that carnival of freaks, you know,
right.
Welcome to the Knight's Breed. And I'm like, all right, great. Until I read here, Society of the Knight, and I went, you dirty tricksters. You dirty, dirty tricksters. This way to pilfer and use material. Well done. Well done. It's your own material. You can't pilfer. But I'm like, okay, put in a different way. I see how they used it.
Yeah.
Well, but here the society. Yeah, sorry.
No, I was just going to say, like, I thought that this, I forever hear the question, well, why would any vampire join, like, a society? And I feel like that's number one, that's at the beginning of every freaking vampire book. But I felt like it very precisely states here under Society of the Night, as you were mentioning, that it's, I'll just read it. At its heart, Knight Society is built on a dichotomy. Vampires are solitary predators without an actual need for companionship of their own kind. Yet this companionship is precisely what they crave. They're like moths to a flame.
Have to have it.
Right.
And also, there's another piece. There's a lot of people who say, you know, why the hell would I go with the mold? I don't want to belong here. And you have that to counter. Then the second piece. Vampires are innately drawn to those stronger than them. Ironically, not just vampires. Any social circle, unit, anything that involves human beings, mankind, vampire, damned or not, I don't care if you're the frickin' Highlander, all right? You are drawn to someone more powerful than you because it's assumed they will make sense of your world.
Right.
They have something you don't, and there's something about, and they do. It's wisdom. And so you go to them to learn your origins, what it's about, where you're from, and they should have this piece. You know, when players sit down and go, I'm taking a mentor of five.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what's your mentor for? I don't want to boost my disciplines. I don't want you to say I can't do it. And I'm like, you don't want to talk to it? This is the weirdest thing ever. Why would you do that? Why not just take a nothing? Okay, right, yeah, sure, right. He's there. Have your abusive Yoda that only emails you how to use a lightsaber. No problem. And the point here is that why do they do that? Well, there's a social dynamic is all from a predatory perspective. They're not human anymore.
Right.
And so that instinct is a raw nerve. And so as they sit back and technically want to be solitary in their domain with their blood, eventually immortality gets them. Eventually immortality gets it. And once that happens, you know, you're drawn to trying to deal with it. And what I mean by that is that you want to go somewhere just to break up the monotony. There's a madness piece you're battling as well.
Right.
Because even though your brain is quote unquote dead, your mind is dead. It's not dead to the fact that, you know, you want someone to remember you or to socialize or to even just be social.
It's like the dichotomy of antisocial behavior. Someone who avoids other people but seeks acceptance externally. You know, it fits right in with the vampiric soul, right? You don't need them, but in order to validate your existence, you search for them. So
that's a better way of saying it. Validate your existence. Absolutely. And they talk about that with the pack animal instincts we mentioned, but the vampire draws from that society another point.
Mm-hmm.
If you're the strongest, you're in charge, right? That's it. They took away a certain age. An age gap is not a single defining factor, right? Kind of peeled back on it. And it's also your influential control because you got to build them domains too. And they point that out. So if you have to rule as a tyrant, sure, but there's got to be something for us. And we'll get to that later of how that's defined. But it's there. But this is sort of what it is. And the society is fiend-based. In other words, murder, intrigue, and unholy acts, those are your new social pillars, right, for self-identity. But they're hidden behind an idea that you're socially dignified, right?
Right?
As Nate said, I may go home and put a laurel on my head and wear the Roman robes, but when I'm in public, I'm going to wear what is custom to the time so that we are not disrupted as I tell you how much better I am than you.
Right.
But not say that directly. Shouldn't have to.
What is the point of power if you don't have others to lord over? Like,
I love you for that. Yes,
it's exactly what we're seeing here. Like, you know, the vampiric is, you know, in this Dark Ages period, the vampiric power is basically just a more vile and oppressive sort of hierarchical leadership rulership than humans. It's humans, but worse.
Exactly. So we're going to flip it here a little bit. So we got the Knight Society established, but Nate, it started, and I said we get to it later, and I take it away with the High Clans, Nate.
So the High Clans are going to be, you know, very much like their mortal counterparts. They are the families, i.e. the clans, that have the highest moral bearing, the highest value, worth, the upright, learned, etc. So the High Clans, we get that very that distinct defining difference between the two cultures. You have your Bruja, your Cappadocian, Lysandra, Torridor, Zamis, and Ventru. Those are your High Clans, your kings, your rulers, your learned. And then you have the Low Clans, those that are either foreign and I use air quotes there, foreign from the dark medieval Europe, or those that are just of a lower bearing, the ugly, the disgusting, the decrepit and insane, the Asimites, the followers of Set, Gangrel, Malkavian, Nosferatu, Ravnos, and Tremere.
What I like about these both is their distinction, right?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't use this. Here's the thing. You didn't need to say High and Low Clan before. You really didn't.
Right.
It was like those who get along with mortals and can cultivate them and control them from afar or exist amongst them naturally would be considered High Clans because they're the better predator. They're able to blend in amongst their food and thus be unnoticed.
Right.
The Low Clans would be those who cause a problem, right? Stand out. They can't do it naturally and they have to go through other means. And before you think it and say it, well, you must mean just Nosferatu,
mm-hmm.
right? And then like the Gangrel Frenzy too much. Like, no, I also mean the Asimites who just don't understand they have a complex hierarchy that is far removed from how vampires typically are. And so they don't really care about blending in with the mortals as much as not existing with them at all.
Right.
And so they do a different thing. Not to say they don't use them, because they certainly do. But to say where the High Clans care about that, they don't. They care more about punishing the wicked sort of thing, according to what they judge. And that's their shtick, you know. And basically, the main distinction is with the High Clans, well, there's a Low Clan divide because the High Clans say they were made first, right?
Right.
In the City of Enoch, their antediluvians were made first. And because of that, they are automatically entitled to the right to rule. And that's an interesting thing. They add some stink on it, though, and say, well, it's not just that. Got to remember, you Low Clans screwed Enoch up. You're the ones who came in and provided unrest, anarchy.
Right. It's a system of laying blame where it might not necessarily need to be laid.
And here's what's interesting. They're kind of right. When you look at it, they are. When you look at the Venshu clan alone, it's been fundamentally unchanged. A lot of the clans have had counter theories about what happened and what did not. The mm-hmm. Venshu have a sound take. And there was one that we had a point on. It was like, it's a nice story. You want to tell us, Lord Harderstat, that, okay, your Enoch was a Venshu progenitor? There he is in the city ruling it, and you came from him, and wait a minute, you decided to rule over everyone, and hang on,
mm-hmm.
the Venshu say the same thing, wait a minute, you do the same, and you honor the, all right, maybe that is the clan that really was from back in the day, and why all the other clans mysteriously, up to the modern, still see them as leaders, right? It's like, okay, we hear you, we get it.
Right.
You kept the traditions, and there they are, and that's your burden. And it is a burden, as we'll learn about that in a minute. Yeah. We roll from there to understanding that, okay, great, we got a high and low clans, we know there's a divide, we know that the low clans are big in pursuing their own agendas and intrigues, and they're not too interested in what goes on in high society, because in the high clans, or high knight society, if you will, another way to look at it, they're really not in touch with what's going on, right? They are in terms of vampiric power plays, and control of mortals, mm-hmm. but for the spirit of the times, they're not with it.
Right.
Right.
And it's because of that, like feudal culture that exists here. And we'll get into that a little bit more, but it is very much a form of feudal rulership in this time.
And there has to be, right? So in here, just a little bit, hierarchy titles of note. And there's some, just definite changes. I'm not going to even say there's some, there's absolute changes. You know, one of my favorite in here was that the prince is not assured because you are the eldest or strongest in blood alone.
Right.
Right. That no longer matters. Now it's time to be politically savvy and to be a force that can be brought to bear, i.e. I could be ninth gen instead of the fourth or fifth or sixth gen.
Right.
I could be ninth gen, and if the people that are in my court, that my vassals, outnumber that sixth gen's vassals, well, guess what clans are getting the support of whom?
Right.
Right? Now, this is that part that's lost in a lot of live-action games, right? The most powerful is not the prince, right? Most likely, that'll be the case. Because if that right. prince, to be that powerful usually means a certain savvy and political right. acumen.
Absolutely.
In other words, you should be social and know how to handle your subjects and you're okay.
Bob, we don't be social in role-playing games. You're crazy.
Right. And that's unfortunately a truth in a lot of time. And so if you have this ninth gen, though, who's here and he's been walking around campaigning, he's been Bernie Sandering everybody, you know, damn the man and all that. And but to effect, just like old Bernie. And he says, hey, you ain't got to like me 100%, but at least I can get you something for your people.
Right.
You just got to owe me something and we'll call it even. Yeah. And I like that, because if we don't like you, we can rally and get rid of you. Yeah, of course you can, sucker. I just told your rivals the same thing.
Right.
You know, and that's how it goes. And then before you know it, that can be the prince now. This is also a cause of unrest. I will call this a seed of chaos. I'll mention some others, but this is definitely a seed planted. It's where they reveal that the demigods of blood are no longer something that cannot topple.
Right.
Right? Because by saying this, you basically open the door for everyone.
Right.
And that's revealing you're quite mortal in terms of title. The second thing, were you shocked to know about the lords?
Well, so I wasn't shocked, but the fact that it was sort of made very like the fact that it's ironed out here and it shows that you have these individual much greater than prince Cainites who are sort of ruling over these massive areas and taking you know, that feudal position of, you know, you are a prince, you will pay fealty to me and I will rule many princes. I knew about it, but I didn't know about it in the sense that it was so obviously stated here. To me, the War of Princes was kind of lost on me before this. I was like, man, well, some princes got angry at each other.
Of course it got lost on you, because what the modern does is kind of lump it all together.
Yeah, right.
Right? They take a little from the buffet and say, run with it. This is good enough as is. And that's exactly what they did. Because let's not forget, folks, this is not the first book that came out, right? This is 2002.
Right.
They had many mistakes come before. I say mistakes because when you make a better version, you learn from the challenges from your.
Right.
Exactly. Right? You had more time to put polish on it. And so this is good.
But now I know, right? I know who, like, Lord Jurgen's not just like a fancy title.
and right, it's things like that that go, aha, got it, right. got it. Even me, my own friends here at Home Game shut me down from using this book. It was you guys. I distinctly remember I had all these Dark Ages book. This came out and I started purchasing this and everybody was like, nah, we already know the Dark Ages rule. Mm-hmm. And nobody likes playing anyway. Nate, I like modern.
Yeah. Okay. I've stated as much on number of podcasts. Like, I don't want to reserve the right to tease
you publicly.
Totally worthwhile. But, you know, that's what happens when you don't read the book.
and it's not me saying, oh, yeah, well, blah, 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 always does it right. No, it's not that. It's that when I read it, I said, oh, this makes a lot of sense. But then my brain went, well, shut it down. No one cares about it.
Right.
Because I didn't know I was doing a podcast later, so I was just letting it go. But when I read it, I was like, wow, blown away. Because I sat there and said, well, Justicar, this is what this becomes.
Yeah.
This is the evolution. When you're the lord of a territory of princes, that's exactly what happens in the modern. Interesting, right? Then this bomb drops with Caitiff. It's an argument that I had thought I made up. And I said, this makes sense to me. Caitiff isn't some not... The typical Caitiff, a player makes Caitiff, says, I'm taking the disciplines I want. Right. Nobody knows who my blood is. I'm mystically awesome. And so my blood is mutable. Meaning, is immutable. It could be anything it wants to and transcend all things. No, it can't, stupid. No, it can't. And I refer to that as Bob, who would tell me that. I'd be like, no, silly. Read what this says. It says a caitiff is a canite without clear blood ancestry. It's not that you don't have it.
Right.
It's that whoever embraced you either didn't know what clan they were a part of, or they just left you and kind of to figure it out. Which means you're not going to have the formal education, the cool onboarding, and all that other stuff of being a vampire. So yeah, naturally, you're going to be whatever it is you can be for points of survival. Whatever direction the beast takes in you. However, to that ST, you absolutely have a clan. And that should be noted.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it should
be. That's where it is. Now, should it be told to you? Probably not. But it's tons of seed for you to plot and have out for that character. And in this era, it's almost a death sentence.
Yeah, it's not good.
If you don't know it, you're welcome to being a mongrel. Right? You're tolerated, but never venerated. You're never boosted above being basically the door guy.
You're like the low clan's low clan.
You're the convenient scapegoat. Mm-hmm. You're the guy we make fun of, and no one comes to your aid. When I get mad and I'm in a frenzy as a Bruja at court, and they're always like, man, that Knight Bob, Bruja Knight Bob's always beating up people. He's always causing unrest. And then I turn around because an important dignitary's there to talk to my prince, and I'm a vassal, and I'm about the frenzy. I look, you caitiff, you exist. You're like, no, not again. And then I beat you, and everyone laughs.
But what's worse than a caitiff, Bob?
Worse than a caitiff is an Altarkus. Right? This term we have mentioned before, and a lot of people wondered, well, where did that come from? Here it is.
Yeah.
It's brought up again. This isn't the origin, but this is better defined.
Yeah.
It's more where you can say, absolutely, here it is. And it's someone who's not bound into any society, or I like to call, usually your average player.
Right?
Comes in, I don't want to say nothing to Prince. I don't like the high uppity people. We're playing a Camarilla game. You got to. No way, screw everybody. All right, don't. And we'll see how long that gets you. And we'll go on that, right? It's going to be a little rough. I don't care. And then usually give up the character. They're frustrated or whatever. But if you set that expectation, especially in this game, hey, if you're Altarkus, basically means they're going to hunt and kill you.
They'll just hunt you and kill you just for the fact that you are who you are. You're a subversive element. You're worse than a caitiff because a caitiff at least acknowledges, I am dog shit meant to be ground under your feet. But I have a place in that, in the culture and the society. Whereas an Autarkus says, I ain't even willing to do that.
When you look at it from the perspective of an Autarkus and caitiff, this whole oppressive society is just, it stands out, right? It's kind of a scary thing. However, does it have to be? Well, let's look at it. Because that all comes down to who's your prince, right?
Right.
And before we get into this, one of the things I love about it, let's talk perks of being a prince. Now, I enjoyed how they laid this out. Nate, you're a prince, but don't fret. I'm giving you a sheriff.
Right.
wait, there's more. We know what a sheriff is, but Nate, you happen to be appointed a juicy peat of domain. Mm-hmm. What did I just say?
A peat?
A juicy bit.
A peat?
A juicy bit of domain. My brain was like, what the hell was that? No, a juicy domain territory, right? Uh-huh. And because you have it, I have a vampire army, but I don't wish to field it. So I am also giving you a war master. Isn't that great?
Mm-hmm. It's great because he's a tactician who's going to need to determine who of my enemies I smite first or get struck down by.
He also, as your vassal, he wears your symbol. It's like you're on the battlefield, but you never have to take it.
Right.
He leads your army and you sit back at your castle going, we'll win the day. I put Bob out there and I go,
they got flame arrows.
Right? That's me. I'm the war leader. That's my war master. I get to do that. Then they propose a seneschal.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. We know what that is.
Yeah.
Right?
That's
more or less holds to that.
Essentially the same. Yeah. That's unchanged.
Right. However, the keeper threw me for a loop.
Right.
When you read that, I was like, whoa.
Yeah, because you probably did the same thing, and you're like, but there isn't really Elysium, so what does the Keeper do? And then you go, oh, this is basically the Sabbat priest of your city. This is the Ashen priest who is the Keeper of the lore.
And what's interesting is that it's dual, right? They list that it's called the Keeper, and a Keeper actually is a council of a mystic or spiritual advisor, which means you can have an oracle. It doesn't have to be an Ashen priest. It could just be a Malkavian whose title is Oracle.
Right.
And they're essentially a keeper in your role. But then they go, that's old school. That's if you want to be old school. Typically, like Nate just said, Ashen Priest. Right. And I was like, whoa, okay. It's pretty pimp.
Yeah, yeah.
That's pimp to remember what that is. Now, why is it? Because an Ashen Priest is an adherent and teacher of one of the Roads of Cain. That's simple. And there's never just one of them.
Right.
Typical courts, a prince is going to let any road have an adherent or have an Ashen Priest and be there. He also listens to them for their advice because later on we're going to explain the power of both. But there's a reason he listens to him or she, not just cuz. Then the Chamberlain, Nate, you get one of those. Now, Chamberlain.
They organize the tournaments.
That's kind of weird. Isn't that what a keeper technically would do? You organize the party?
Yeah, basically. Well,
right. So the modern Chamberlain is called a keeper. We do away with the road adherent because that's bad.
Right.
So back here we have a Chamberlain, and what do they do now? They're the harpy.
Yeah.
They organize the party, invite the right people. They comb the scum of pond for all sorts of how's the Lord ruling? How's Nate doing? Is it good or bad?
Yeah.
Do you like Nate Chamberlain? I can say whatever I like.
Keeping
he's far over there.
Right. They're keeping their finger on the pulse of society.
But don't worry, Nate, I know. Before you think I'm a terrible sire, I want to point something out to you. I'm also giving you a secret assassin. It's called a scourge.
Yeah,
now,
yeah.
It's bad form to let the scourge walk around with all the head severed dangling from his head. I made that mistake once or twice. It was fun for a laugh,
yeah.
But gets pretty long. Well, I got depressed when I saw it stretch far beyond the coach.
I like that this book shows you, you see these old sort of anachronistic titles and positions, and you see one, how they sort of influenced and led to the positions within the Camarilla. But then also when you look at like the Camarilla in V20, you see, oh yeah, some of these are starting to come back. And before V20, you know, revised, we see that scourge. And I just think it was clever and obvious, but clever that, you know, they kind of interchange based on how culture and society change as well.
Well, we know where this came from. If you remember, LARP didn't have any of these.
Yeah.
There was a prince and whatever, and LARP kind of went around. And obviously, you listen to your fans and how they're using it, making it different. And before you know it, this became, they were in LARP books, and they were defined, and it's how folks are using them. And it was awesome to see it in a book, finally. Mm-hmm. Right? Everybody loved it. And the modern books had it. But to see it here and how they just basically went back and cheekily was like, no, it was always here. Here's what it meant. And I was like, that's awesome, because now they bridge that gap between past to future and makes it past to modern, I should say. And that makes it easier to understand when you can see the full picture and where that goes. Now, to keep going, we have princely rights, too. Now, we gave you the carrot. Let's tell you what stick you get to use. Now, you never get hit with your own stick, but, you know, here's what you got to uphold. Four little things, right? First off, you're a princely rite of destruction.
Right.
Who doesn't know rite of destruction?
Yeah, it's, you're not allowed right. to kill anybody unless you're the prince or you give the you're given the order from the prince.
Pretty simple. That's the prince's right. Don't step on it.
Right.
Right. Siring, also a prince's right. In fact, you, Nate, cream of the crop. You get to embrace him as many as you like, whoever you like. However, other people are going to have to ask you permission, even me.
Right.
I might be your sire, but making you prince, huh? If I want to make that cute little ass down at the tavern forever mine, I better go and tell you, what are you doing this for, Bob? Well, I want to make her mine. And you're like, no, she brings blood in. Pick someone else.
Right.
Really? I made you. See this title? Have fun.
Right.
Then naturally, we have domain.
Right.
And obviously, a prince's domain can be anything from a city. They cite some examples. Like, there'd be city, a larger territory, like, you know, the Iberian Peninsula, if you're such a badass. But mostly, you control a large domain and people owe you fealty while they're there. And this is where it gets interesting, right?
Right.
Because they have a little, I would call it the other shoe. If you visit a prince's domain, you're automatically a vassal of the prince. If you stay there. Like, if I go there one night, say, hi, Nate, how's it going? I'm going to be sticking around for 2 weeks, if I permit it.
Right.
What do you mean? What are you here for? Thank you for respecting me to come here and announce yourself, honoring the traditions of course, the Covenant of Cain. Since you're doing that, how long are you going to be? How long are you staying? Well, longer than a night. Well, now that you're my vassal, why should I keep you?
Right.
What are you, what?
Right.
That's what you're doing.
Right.
That's what you're doing. And here you see that piece of someone saying, why the hell do we go and tell this guy we're here anyway?
Right. Well, and I think that this is an important thing to remember as well, that all of this, this entire culture, this entire society is based on being able to maintain domain, right? That's your territory, right? The prince says, I am the ruler of this domain, right? This city, we'll say, look, Paris, France. I am the ruler of Paris, France. I can maintain this entire domain because I am powerful enough to do so. But in all actuality, what's happening is I'm powerful enough and you are my vassal, which means you are in charge of that city block or that ward or whatever, right? So now you have to control that and you have to maintain that and I rule through you. And above me somewhere is this lord who is in control of all this domain, but that's because there's a prince here, right? It's just shit right. rolling downhill and you better be on top of it. Because if you're not...
You have to be.
Right. Because if you're not, bad stuff is going to happen.
Now remember, these are the rights of the prince. This stuff he can do willy-nilly. Mm-hmm. Give it to whoever or keep it. Yeah. But then he also has feeding rights.
Right.
We know that. But what this basically means is the prince assigns rules to the feeding grounds, right? So we're going to have... Okay, you could feed here. A lot of people say, yeah, what's the... Where's the rack? What's the importance of that? Well, it's simple. The prince personally cultivates the rack. Makes it to where a lot of mortals are going to go there, and they're gonna spend money, live there, shop there, whatever it is.
Right.
And they make it to where when you choose to feed, you can go there and do so. However, he's going to attach rules to his feeding grounds.
Right.
Right? Those are feeding grounds you're permitted if you're a vassal.
Right.
And because of that, I tell you something weird. Like, you can only feed in a full moon. Right? Anyone's house right. that keeps right. a laurel of roses out the front, you may not touch.
You may only go there on a Wednesday.
Right? Only those who haven't gone to church may you feed upon.
You may only feed during happy hour between the hours of 8 p.m. and 10 p.m. Monday, Wednesday, Friday.
You may only feed if I've washed my feet. Okay.
You may only feed off of those wearing Nike shoes. Hey, you're the prince. Who knows why, but that's the rule you made, you know?
Gotta get those new Jordans now, man. Get them Nikes. They're cheaper. Trust me. You good. All right. Anyway, and then the vassals go, well, what the hell, man? We give him all this stuff. What does he give us? Well, that's interesting because the prince has duties.
Right.
Right. Straight up has duties.
Here's where I apologize for interrupting you, but here's where I would say people that are confused about like what a prince does in the Camarilla, you should read this section under rights and responsibilities because it directly adapts, even if they don't come out and say it. When you're the prince, you're not just like, I am the badass and I have no responsibility. Why do elders get tired of princes, or why do princes get you know, taken out of that position? Because even if it doesn't say it in here, in a modern day context, this is what the prince is supposed to do. So continue.
For sure.
Continue.
For sure. I also don't want to because that says it perfect. Right, but right. What he's talking about is princely duties. It's upholding the ways, i.e. the traditions.
Right.
They grant the prince praxis, a.k.a. the right to rule, and they must be defended. It's that simple. He has to uphold traditions. This dates back to that Ventru Clan Book Revised,
right,
where they talk about the burden of leadership. This is what they're referring to, right? That we got to do this. So not necessarily fun, but it's duty. Protection. What this means is that if you're my vassal, if you came and got acknowledged, you're sticking around and you're cool and you're here, even if you're not cool, I don't like you, you're a piece of... But you uphold my rule, so be it.
Right.
What, no matter what I personally feel, if someone comes and kills you, and that's what it's referring to, someone can come beat you up, I'm going to be angry.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to figure out what that was about. But if it was in-house, so be it.
Right.
Fights happen. However, let's say an autarchus, or worse, somebody who's... let's say a caitiff.
Mm-hmm.
Got uppity and decided to lay hands on you, and he lives in the hamlet where we put him. Oh, he's dead.
Right.
And we have to, because if I cannot answer for that, for another person's vassal laying hands on one of my vassals, I look weak because I can't uphold my duty,
right,
which is to grant that protection. And there's two ways I could do it. I wasn't there, they kill you, but now retribution's my next plan.
Right.
There must be a punishment. Otherwise, you know, we're going to start leaving the ship.
Right.
Now, the third one. And I would argue the most important out of all this, really. Really, they're all important, honestly. But shepherding the flock. This is where we talk about keeping the hunting grounds, getting everybody together, making sure there's steady food supply, a sizable city to feed upon. And it stays sane. We can't have chaos where we can't know what's going on. And we also can't have chaos because we need everybody to come here to farm the land, to live off the land, to be profitable, and thus grow. And I shouldn't have to explain that, but let me tell you something. No food, no domain of worth. You attack my money, I'm going to kill you.
Right.
Right? It's that simple.
Right.
So that's how a prince goes from, the title prince and becomes that dude from New Jack City. Right?
Right. We then go into a little bit of the concept of upholding the old ways. The traditions. There is really none that I can find any difference between the traditions here and the traditions in the earlier material. It's the traditions.
What I could tell you the one difference, because it seemed awkward, but it's spiritually important as much as it is. It's temporal and it's actual, mm-hmm, political. And that's the covenant, the first tradition.
Right.
Right. If you know what the tradition of the covenant is, sorry if we repeat, but I feel we have to review this. Right. So the tradition of the covenant states basically... You have to agree to uphold the covenant of Cain, where he states that these are my traditions and thus my covenant. And if you uphold it and you're a part of it, fantastic,
right?
Then all of this is yours and all things will be gravy. But if you choose not to be a part of it, you're damned. Truly damned.
It's the law that says you must follow the laws.
Yeah, essentially. But when you think of it in a spiritual sense, they truly believe Cain stepped up, and by the way, I do too, because the only way this all makes sense, there's got to be an origin. Someone has to be the point.
Sure.
And they made one, right? So whatever. But since they did, and it's like, I follow Cain, do you, brother? And you're like, I do, but I'm in the Cainite heresy. You know, great, we're still good, because technically you're upholding the covenant. Wink. You know, just FYI.
Right.
But then pretty much this all points out to be the same thing, right? We know about the rest of it, and we don't necessarily need to beat a dead horse with it, but Lex Talionis.
Mm-hmm.
It's a complex term, right? A lot of people get this confused, right? I've heard, I'm going to declare praxis lex talionis.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to claim the right to rule over the vampiric laws set forth by Cain. Is that what you meant? Nah, man, I'm just trying to steal the domain. No, you actually, what I just said is what you just said. Right? You said you have a divine right held forth by Cain to rule. But no, essentially, this is those whom break a prince's law are slain.
Yeah, it's
the short version.
It's the law of retaliation, the way of ruling through retribution.
And it's interesting because you can't refute it, but this is echoes of Hammurabi, right? Hammurabi made his code, right? He's the mighty ruler who said, you know what? My God told me that I'm going to make these laws, so I'm going to build these giant steles, or steles if you prefer, and I'm going to put them in the ground for all time. They'll never rot. We still saw them in the modern. Hymns thousands of years ago, like BC era.
Right.
And that's insane, right? To think that there are laws still. We were like an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. And it's interesting.
Yeah.
If you ever want a fun time, go back and look at it, see the differences. But
But
I digress.
But it's also a way of ensuring that the crime fits the punishment, or the punishment fits the crime. It's, you know, not just, well, you insulted me at court, blood hunt. Like, it's an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth.
Well, here's the thing. It can be.
Sure.
And it outlines that.
Sure.
Right? And it's not considered abuse in this era. You know? So, mm-hmm. if Nate walks in with Nikes and I said tonight it's Jordans, but I don't like Nate.
Right.
I go, blood hunt this fool. He ain't wearing the right shoes. Well, if people like Nate, now we're into a political stickiness, right? He's going to get killed. Nate, you're dead. But then people are going to go, man, pull the support of the brew.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's a very delicate balancing act between being, you know, maintaining support and losing credibility.
But to help me, Bob the Tyrant, if I'm up on the throne and I'm like, yeah, man, he rolled the wrong shoes, kill him. Leans in, the Ashen Priest, my lord, I do believe on your road of kings. But that might be a good idea. How about we brand Nate on the forehead, the symbol of Nike?
Right, right.
That's a great way of reminding him to wear the right shoe.
Do you know what this reminds me of? I don't know if you've ever watched Better Call Saul. But in Better Call Saul, yes. Saul gets taken by Tuco, and there's these two twins that are like running a con. But anyways, Tuco's like, I'm going to kill them all. And Saul's like, you know, we could kill them for sure. But, you know, what message does that send? It says you're not fair, right? So maybe you do, maybe don't kill them. Maybe make it so that they can't skateboard. Yeah, cut off their legs. And he's like, well, maybe. And it escalates from there to the point where he's convincing them. He's convincing Tuco, maybe you break one of their legs. But yeah, you have these tyrants who, you know, they maybe it might not be so easy for them to maintain that level of credibility. You know, this hopefully Lex Talionis helps them to met out revenge in an appropriate manner.
Ordeals, folks. That's where it's at.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's where the circus comes out.
Right.
Nate goes, nah, I don't want a branding. And you ain't gonna kill me. I call for an ordeal. Trial by combat. Bob goes, great. Fight my five-headed ogre. The Zamish just made him. He's 18 feet tall. Took five knights. It's great.
Right,
like,
right.
All right. I thought like a human. Nah, he's like a human, except he can punch through a tree.
Right.
You know, this should be fun. And if you win, I guess you're clear, right? Stuff like that. But they get into other things. Just to highlight the creativity of it. Trial by fire. I always crack up when people think, what's the point? Don't I just die? No. A trial by fire is where they say something like, here's a ring from your mortal beloved, the wife you would like to embrace. Now, you went ahead and embraced her, and I should kill you. You're her sire, and she's in the other room. Instead, if you can get this ring out of this fire before it melts, well, then I guess you could have her. And you drop it in. Now, this won't necessarily kill you, but let's just say you're going to remember the moment.
Right.
Right? But if you're able to do it, you and her live, but now you're under the accounting, all that jazz, and you look a fool. But the point is, wasn't love worth it?
Yeah, right.
I don't know. You have to be, it's you. You're Edward Burnt Stumphands at that point. I don't know what happens, but that's on your call. But that's it. And then Test of the Beast is what you think it is. I'm going to put you in a scenario where you shouldn't frenzy, but if you do,
mm-hmm.
I kill you.
Right.
You know? Or even if you pass it, I'm the prince. I kept you in a cage and starved you to see if you'd frenzy if I brought a woman out and had her just cut her cheek. Oh, yeah, you frenzied. I leave you there for all time.
Well, and I think that a lot of this stuff, too, reminds me of punishment that can be levied in the Camarilla for transgressions in the modern context. But also, it kind of reminds me of some Sabbat shit, too, which I like. I like that I'm able to see those elements that influence the creation of the two sects later, you know, a couple hundred years from now. In the context of vampiric existence, we're not that far off. You know, we're only a couple hundred years from that split, from where, you know, the Anarch Revolt happens and the two sects end up formulating individually. So I like that.
Yep. I also like the fact that what they roll into from there is they have a distinction between princely titles and what they could get in their domain. Then they go, let's talk feudal Lex Talionis,
mm-hmm.
right? And when they get to here, it's a term means canine feudalism,
yep.
right? They are definitely mimicking mortals at this point, being heavily influenced by them. And they say, hey, if there's kings, lords, and ladies, and all that stuff, we're going to have the same thing
right.
in our knight society. and they get in this title of a monarch. One thing that blew me away more than anything else, you always hear about Methuselah's being hidden, can't be accessed, or never really part of the canon, don't get involved.
Right.
And you don't hear about Antediluvians either. And here they're like, nah, Jack, they exist.
Right.
Like, flat out. Right, like, right. Everyone knows, nah, they're real, you better understand that. Right. And that's, know who your monarch is, basically.
Right.
And what's a monarch, Dan?
Well, a monarch is basically the, probably like the oldest, most powerful active member of the clan. They talk about the Ventru Mithras or the Lysandra Montano, individuals like key powerful figures active in the War of Princes. Like, the truth is, Mithras was like all of these islands, all of this England, United Kingdom thing here that hasn't even formed yet. That's mine. I'm going to be prince, but also I'm just going to engage from here.
Right. You also have that that idea that monarch's main cause is to rule lords and ladies. Mm-hmm. It's that simple, right?
Right.
We already outlined that a lord rules over multiple princes. Here's a monarch that rules over multiple lords.
Right.
We're talking playing pool with the planets practically with this, right?
It's like a very like inner circle sort of mentality. It's you know, if you think about it from like the Vampire the Eternal Struggle card game kind of mentality, when you sit down with your deck, you're a monarch, basically.
Right. That's exactly the role you're taking at that point. And then they roll it on down. They go, we know what a prince is, right? Mm-hmm. And they rule over barons and baronesses, but we never even heard that yet. And of course there are barons and baronesses. They rule over knights.
Right.
You know what a knight is. And knights serve as vassals, and they're the lowest rung that has a title.
Right.
In the knight society. However, there are titleless people. Right? Your vast majority of your low clans aren't going to have a title.
Right.
And that's just how it is, because they're not acknowledging themselves in any one area usually, or they're working on their own thing amongst the, well, we'll just say it, the not so profitable middle to low class, right? And that's how that all rolls in. Now, why it's important is because they also mimic fealty. And before you think this is where, I heard this said to me one time, which is why I'm taking such a hard stance on it, so everybody just kind of bear with me here. My first LARP, someone told me you have to go to the prince and drink his blood once, and oh, you owe him fealty.
Well, I said, what? That's a hard line, but yeah, I've been in games like that too, where they were like, if you want to get acknowledged, you have to be 1 point bloodbound to the prince. And I was like, time to turn anarch.
So what I said was, what do I get for the 1 point bloodbound?
Right.
Right? Made it a whole thing. And he was like, what do you mean? And I was like, well, because this isn't a real fealty.
Right.
Right, real fealty, I've rehearsed my oath. Right? I know I have to take an oath and a vow, right? I got to go in and say some stuff. He's going to say some stuff. We both mean it. We talked about it ahead of time, that this is a good fit. and we do it and we're in, right?
Right.
And that's how it's supposed to be. And if it's not going to go that way, that's sort of the issue. So basically, fealty is given from lower rung to higher in station, and that's how you keep that oath. So you talked about Mithras, the Isles of Avalon. There's a lot of people underneath Mithras that all would take a fealty, an oath to him, regarding, especially if they're going to be prince.
Right.
Right. In his area, just makes sense. Now, that's enough talk about the higher end. The end that I'm most interested in, which I hope you are too, is the Ashen Priesthood.
Yeah. Getting into the roads and kind of making them more multidimensional. As far as this material is concerned.
Well, the Ashen Priest said, like, I think first and foremost, that they rule over kings, right?
Right.
The Ashen... I said that wrong. It's just me being distracted. Sorry. The Ashen Priest said they have a rule of kings versus the power of the church, right? Temporal power versus actual is what the mortals are going through in the 13th century.
Right.
They mimic this here.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. We will be back next week with part two of our review of Dark Ages Vampire Core Book. Thank you for listening to 25 Years of Vampire the Masquerade. If you like our podcast and you'd like to help support our show, consider backing us at patreon.com/25 Years of Vampire the Masquerade. We offer reward tiers of additional Patreon-only podcasts, t-shirts, and personalized gaming experiences. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, and go to our website, utilitymuffinlabs.com, for links to all of our social media, additional podcasts, and more. If you'd like to chat with us, submit a title for review, promote your gaming-related stuff, or anything else you can think of, email me at nathan@utilitymuffinlabs.com. Utility Muffin Labs, consistently rated adequate.